The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Okay, good afternoon. I think we're going to get started. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Steve Vladek. I'm a professor of law here at American University, Washington College of Law. And it's my pleasure to welcome you to this afternoon's program on Don't Ask, Don't Tell, Beyond the Log Cabin Republicans Injunction and the Defense Authorization Act. We have a pretty jam-packed panel scheduled for you today, so I'm going to be brief in my opening remarks. But I think it's safe to say that Don't Ask, Don't Tell has a prominence and a significance today, perhaps that only rivals its prominence and significance when it was first promulgated early in the Clinton administration on two distinct fronts. The last year has seen a lot of movement on Don't Ask, Don't Tell with regard to a potential repeal by Congress, or at least a softening by the administration, and also with the lawsuit by the Log Cabin Republicans culminating with the injunction of Don't Ask, Don't Tell by a federal district judge in California. That injunction, of course, is now on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. So one might actually even wonder if the question with regard to Don't Ask, Don't Tell is not so much whether it will be repealed and or struck down, but when. But to try to sort of answer that question, to get at the underlying basis for the policy, to talk a bit about the history of it and where we are today, we've brought together four really true experts to talk about these issues. And so our format for today is going to be as follows. I am going to briefly introduce the four panelists. They're each going to give opening statements of no more than 10 minutes. Less is always good. Then we're going to have some moderated back and forth among the panel, and then we're going to turn it over to questions from you guys. You may notice at the end of each row there are slips of paper. The student organizers have asked that if you have questions, please write them down. We're going to try something new today, you know, actually writing down your questions. And they'll collect them at the end of the panel presentation, and then we'll ask them of the panelists during the Q&A. Finally, Dean Verona, who is currently leading his comment section, will be here toward the end to give some closing remarks. So that's our plan. As I said, we have a great lineup. Let me briefly introduce them. You have more complete biographies in your material, so I'm going to spare you, and I dare say them, all of them, but at least here's who they are, going in the order in which they're speaking. First, we have Mr. David Ritgers, who's a legal policy analyst for the Cato Institute. He concentrates on civil liberties, counterterrorism, and criminal justice. And prior to joining Cato, Mr. Ritgers served in the U.S. Army as an infantry and special forces officer, including three tours in Afghanistan, and he has been decorated many, many times. So David Ritgers will be first. Following David is Professor Michelle McClure. Michelle is the Executive Director of the National Institute of Military Justice, which many of you here at WCL have already come to know. Prior to serving in that capacity, Michelle served as an active duty judge advocate in the U.S. Air Force for over a decade, including time as a prosecutor, a base defense counsel, and a senior defense counsel in courts-martial throughout the Western United States and the Pacific Rim. After Michelle, and to her two seats to her right, is David McCain, who's a staff attorney for the Service Members Legal Defense Network. He is also an alumnus of this law school. So welcome back, David. Prior to joining the Service Members Legal Defense Network, David was a law clerk for the Honorable Stephen Salant of the Circuit Court for Montgomery County. And last but certainly not least is Ty Cobb. Ty's a legislative director. He's the legislative director.
Legislative counsel.
Legislative counsel. Oh, see? You know we promoted you.
I know. I'll take it.
Okay. If we do it, it must be true. Legislative counsel for the Human Rights Campaign. And his work focuses on hate crimes, the military, veterans, the judiciary, political appointments, and related issues. Before joining the Human Rights Campaign, Ty was counsel to the late Senator Edward Kennedy on the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee of the U.S. Senate. So we have people who know of what they speak, and I'm going to get out of the way and turn it over to David Ritgers. Thank you.
You're tall.
I know.
Thank you for coming here. I have to give a little bit more of my bio because of the topic we're talking about. I actually am a reserve judge advocate, so I serve as a reserve military lawyer So 1 week in a month and a couple weeks in the summer, I do this this stuff for a living. So we've heard about this controversy about Don't Ask, Don't Tell in the courts. And if I were to give a title to what I'm going to say, it would be status quo ante, the way things were before. You may not have that impression from the news, but just to recap what the courts have done, on September 9th, Judge of Virginia Phillips, a district judge in the Central District of California, declared the policy of Don't Ask, Don't Tell to be unconstitutional. And then on October 12th, she granted a worldwide immediate injunction against the enforcement of the policy by the Department of Defense. And on October 19th, the military recruiters were told you can openly accept gay applicants. And on October 20th, Lieutenant Daniel Choi, an openly gay man who had previously been discharged under Don't Ask, Don't Tell, re-enlisted. However, that lasted for a little more than a day, I think. Anyway, so November 1st, there was So the next day, that the there's a temporary stay on that, so now the recruiters have to go back to the old language. November 1st, the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, they stayed the worldwide injunction, and now the service chiefs have advised service members coming into the service, we're still working under Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So we're back where we started. So a little bit of history. Where did Don't Ask, Don't Tell come from? How did it come to be? And what does it mean to service members who are serving right now? So this started in the beginning of the Clinton administration. Right after Clinton came into office, he said, we're going to repeal the prohibition on gays serving openly in the military. There was a lot of controversy about this. And the compromise came in the National Defense Authorization Act of 1994, which codified the exclusion policy for the military. And it said that you can be kicked out of the service under three conditions: statements, acts, or marriage. It's actually acts, statement, and marriage in the order of the statute, but it's the military, so we have to have a three-letter acronym that we can just pronounce easily. So it's SAM, statements, acts, or marriage. So if you were to tell someone in your chain of command or provide somehow evidence came out that you had engaged in homosexual acts, or you had married or attempted to marry someone while you're in the military, then you can be kicked out of the service. Now, when I say kicked out of the service, you may not have any exposure to the military justice system. That's not actually a punishment at trial. This is an administrative separation, sometimes what we call ADSEP, and actually more commonly in the Army, it's called being chaptered out. There's a chapter for each kind of misconduct that they can separate you from the service. This is Chapter 10. And this proceeding, once again, it's not a criminal trial, it's not a court-martial, but it's an administrative board. They conduct a hearing. It's composed largely of non-attorneys, but they'll often have a legal advisor appointed who will rule on admissibility of evidence. However, the military rules of evidence, which parallel the federal rules of evidence that you have or will learn about, do not apply. So very loose rules of evidence. The burden of evidence is on the government, but it's only proven to a preponderance of the evidence. So we're, 51% sure that we should kick this person out of the service, is the bottom line. There is an exception written in at the end of the statute and applied in the regulations that if the government finds that such acts are a departure from the soldier's usual behavior, they're unlikely to recur, that they were not accomplished by use of force, coercion, or intimidation, and that retention is in the best interest of the Army, and the soldier doesn't have a propensity to engage in the acts in the future, then they can keep you in the service. I don't know the number of applications of the policy where that happens. Probably very, very rare. So this is a really unique situation with this policy, because this is an instance where we're going to have all three branches of government weigh in on a policy within a span of about 2 months. This almost never happens on one issue. So you had legislative action pushing to change the policy in September. I know that's going to get covered by some other folks in the panel. The executive branch in the form of the military is currently conducting a review of the policy. The feedback from this review of policy is due to the Secretary of Defense by December 1st, while at the same time Congress is going to be in a lame duck session. The judiciary is waiting, as I mentioned before. So this is really this convergence of these, all three branches of government, and yet the policy remains the same. There's been some proposals about changing the policy. Of course, we've heard about the legislative things, or we'll hear more about them. There's also the proposal to use an executive order to change the policy. So how would this happen? There are two laws that in the federal code. Title 10 of the federal code pertains to the military. Two portions of that law, one pertaining to enlisted separations and policy for promotion and retirement, and then one for suspending officer personnel laws during a time of war or national emergency, allow the president to stop separating people from the service. This is what we know colloquially as the stop loss policy. So while people are deploying to fight overseas, or there's a national emergency, I suppose, if we were invaded, then we wouldn't let you out of the Army because the country needs you. And the president conceivably could use this power, and I think along with a statement of the sort of retention is in the best interest of the service part that's written into the exception at the end of the policy, to stop administratively separating gay service members. And I should also note that there are criminal charges for certain sexual acts in the Uniform Code of Military Justice, the criminal law for the armed forces, still on the books. And Article 125 of the UCMJ, the Uniform Code of Military Justice, continues to criminalize sodomy. But in light of the 2003 Supreme Court decision, Lawrence versus Texas, the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces, that's the highest court in the military, has reduced this to an as-applied law. So there's a really good article in January 2009 issue of Army Lawyer that talks about how the application of the sodomy article of the UCMJ it basically compares it to the statement of Miracle Max. This is Billy Crystal's character in The Princess Bride, when he says, "Your friend here is only mostly dead." And there's a big difference between being mostly dead and all dead. Now, mostly dead, he's still slightly alive. So when you conduct a survey of the prosecutions under this provision of the Uniform Code of Military Justice, most of them are bad fact patterns, but there hasn't been where there's something else going on, where there's adultery still commonly prosecuted under the Uniform Code of Military Justice, or fraternization, where it's sexual contact between a superior and a subordinate, which we view in the military as prejudicial to the good order and discipline of the force, and that's a prosecutable offense. It's barred by the fraternization policy and still prosecutable if it involves sodomy under this article of the UCMJ. We should also note that in 2005, the Joint Service Committee on Military Justice recommended a complete revamping. They recommended not doing anything to the sexual misconduct laws in the military, but Congress took the second option, revamped it all, and then, against the advice of the Joint Service Committee on Military Justice, kept the sodomy law intact. So it's a mess. So the bottom line is, really, if you're going to fix Don't Ask, Don't Tell, you have to fix a lot of things. You have to fix the rest of the sexual misconduct laws within the Uniform Code of Military Justice. So once again, where are we? Right where we started. And including in that story of right where we started, I like to talk about an anecdotal case, the case of Sergeant Darren Manzella. Darren Manzella was a combat medic at Fort Hood. After a combat tour in Iraq, he began to live as an openly gay service member. His chain of command knew about it. With another tour in Iraq pending, his chain of command, they investigated the claim that he was gay. He provided them pictures and video with him and his boyfriend. And they said, "Well, you know, you're a good sergeant, you're a good combat medic, and we just don't see any evidence of homosexuality." So he had given them plenty of evidence, right? But they had a deployment to Iraq coming up, and so they said, "Yeah, we just don't see it, sorry." So he wasn't discharged. He didn't want to be discharged. Now, his subsequent appearance on 60 Minutes telling his story gave the chain of command no choice, and he was discharged. But I think that part of that where we are and where we have been traditionally is that gay service members during times of conflict are generally allowed to serve, and it isn't until the cessation of hostilities that these people get kicked out of the service en masse. And I think that, with cases like Sergeant Manzella and with the number of Arabic translators who have been kicked out, I think it continues to damage our services. I know that the Service Members Legal Defense Network has some more current numbers. I'd be interested in hearing what those numbers are. In short, I'd say that it is damaging our combat readiness. And I'm persuaded by the experience of other militaries, including the British and the Israelis, to maintain highly effective combat forces while allowing gays to serve openly. So I look forward to a change in the policy. Constitutionally, I'm of the firm belief that it has to come from Congress. I'm not a big fan of going the executive order route. But I'll go ahead and wrap it up there, and in case I forgot to say it earlier, my comments are mine only and not those of the Army or the Department of Defense. All right, thank you.
Thank you, David. Michelle.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to give a few facts, some facts that may surprise some of you based on what you see in the media. I know it's shocking. The media doesn't always give you an accurate view of things. And also leave you with some food for thought as to when there is a repeal, and I believe there will be a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And the first thing that I wanted to point out is that, at least in the Air Force, I don't know what it's like in the other services as much, but we never called it Don't Ask, Don't Tell, certainly not in the legal community, because we viewed this as not being an accurate reflection of what the policy is. It's not as simple as, we're not going to ask if you're homosexual, and you're not supposed to say if you're homosexual. It goes much beyond that, and as you heard David say, it's marriage, attempt to marry. It is as simple as, I am a homosexual. That's enough to get you kicked out of the military, to be fired. But we never called it Don't Ask, Don't Tell, because it was a much broader policy than simply, if everyone stays quiet, then you're going to be good. Because that's not, in fact, what the issue is. How many folks can give a percentage of the numbers of females? If you had, 100% is how many females were discharged for the homosexual conduct policy from the military in the last few years, what percentage would you say would be female? And I'll give you a little bit of a hint to help you out. The military itself overall has about 14% female population. So do you think it would be higher or lower than that would be female that are discharged? Higher. How much higher? I'm hearing over 50. I'm hearing, I see somebody saying lower. I'm hearing twice. It's actually more along the lines of, I've seen several numbers, 46 to 48% of recent individual service members who've been kicked out of the military for homosexual conduct have been female. And that's, again, with a population that's sizably smaller than that, a third of that. So that's something you don't really hear about very much. You also hear a lot about witch hunts and that there are people going around, and I don't discount that there are some of these. I mean, we have, and the other panelists can certainly talk about this, some horrendous cases of harassment and abuse and even death, the Winchell case from a number of years ago. But what percentage of, say, and we'll have, I'm sure, more definitive numbers, although at the beginning the military didn't track specifically homosexual discharges after the law changed in 1993. So the estimates that we have are simply estimates. I think they've been refined somewhat over the years and are somewhat accurate. But say you have 14,000 or so who have been discharged for homosexual conduct under the policy. The vast majority of those individuals are actually self-identifiers. I can talk about a few specific cases that I was involved in as a defense counsel or as the government representative on the other side of these cases. And oftentimes what happened was these were individuals who were wonderful performers, never had a speck of any sort of misconduct on their record. Oftentimes they were NCOs. They had been serving for 10 or more years, great careers in front of them, no indications of any future issues. But they simply had reached a point, and this is what they would write. They would write a very short statement usually saying, I've been wrestling with this for some time, and I love my military career, but I've realized that I need to, as part of being honest with myself, acknowledge that I am homosexual, and I want to be able to act on that. And I realize that that's incompatible with me staying in the military. And so rather than continuing to try to hide their sexuality or have somebody out them later under not their own terms, oftentimes, in the vast majority of cases, that's what has happened, is these are individuals who have reached that point where they say, I can't live this double life anymore, and always be in fear of what if somebody sees me, or what if somebody finds something out, or, you know, a lot of the cases that you see that are not the self-admissions are the spurned lover or ex-lover, or in the case of one individual who is quite familiar to those of us who worked in this area, Major Margaret Witt, in which the husband of her love interest wrote a scathing email, sent it all the way, you know, Chief of Staff of the Air Force, about, hey, I just wanted to let you know, here's what the major's doing. You need to kick her out. Those are, I would say, those cover those two instances, the self-admissions and the spurned individuals outing others are probably the vast, vast majority of individuals. But we also have, even though the military doesn't protect as far as being able to keep your job, homosexual conduct, there are policies in place that varying degrees of ability to combat potential bad acts that are in place to prevent harassment. And I've seen some things that say, well, it should be don't ask, don't tell, don't harass, or that type of thing. And I would argue that there actually is don't harass already on the books. Partly because we have so many civilians who work with the military these days, oftentimes deploying with the military. And these individuals don't have the same restrictions that military members do when they're in combat zones, or even your daily life around the base. And in order to keep a polite atmosphere, in order to keep an atmosphere that isn't sexually harassing, no matter what your sexual orientation is, there are ways that that can be punished under the Uniform Code of Military Justice. The services have individual policies on this that can be punished under Article 92, which is failure to obey a lawful general regulation, as well as under Article 93, depending on what the level of the individual's position is, maltreatment. So there are some things in place already, and for the most part, I'll leave the rest of my remarks for questions, because I find that that's usually the most useful thing for the audience. Thank you.
Thanks, Michelle. Next, we'll hear from David McKinn.
Thank you very much. Well, I have a couple things that I wanted to talk about, but I'd like to start by just responding elaborating on a couple of things that the previous speakers have said. Just so that we know what we're talking about here, when David said there's three types of conducts, the SAM acronym, statements, acts, and marriage, a statement is a statement of your sexual orientation or words to that effect at any time, anywhere, to anyone, before you were in the military, after you were in the military, if you're still serving once you've joined. And it includes things just like, to a friend, in confidence, I'm gay. If that friend turns that information over, that can constitute a statement under the regulation. So it's not just a don't tell, as Michelle was saying, don't tell us and we won't bother you. It's really a don't tell anyone. And I speak to a lot of people who aren't out to their families or aren't out to anyone who they're close to out of fear that this will have a negative impact on their job. Secondly, with respect to acts, that's defined very broadly so that investigations can be opened on the basis of holding hands, hugging. We had two huggings cases in a couple of years. So these things are very, very broad. One case was started, or one investigation at least was started, when a photo of a service member in his locker depicted him with his arm around another guy. An investigation was opened. That other guy turned out to be his cousin. He was not gay. There was nothing there. But nonetheless, he endured a couple months of questioning and scrutiny of his life. And so I think it's important to recognize that it's not just a don't ask provision. In fact, there's really, if you look at the law, there's nothing in the law itself, the statute 10 U.S.C. 654, that says don't ask. At the end of the law, there's something called a sense of Congress provision that says it's our sense that Congress, or that the military should not be asking people when they join whether or not they are in fact gay. But that doesn't mean that people aren't asked, one, in the course of their daily lives between friends, you know, what did you do this weekend? What are you going to do for Thanksgiving? Things like that, that people have to make a decision whether or not they're going to just not answer questions that are totally legitimate and not from a bad place at all, or whether they're going to make up an elaborate story about what in fact they're doing this weekend and who they went and saw a movie with. The other things I would like to mention are the statistic that Michelle referenced in terms of women, that mirrors our numbers as well. It should also be pointed out that of that percentage of women, women of color make up the largest percentage of that. And so I think it's definitely fair to say that women of color are some of the most disproportionately impacted people with respect to don't ask, don't tell. And finally, I would just like to comment on the statement Michelle made about harassment. I think that is true. There are very stringent harassment policies put in place so that, you know, people in the military don't face harassment on a number of issues. Part of the issue with that we find is that it's very difficult to report the harassment on the basis of sexual orientation when you can't tell anyone that you're gay. So going into your supervisor, or going into your commanding officer and saying, hey, listen, there's a couple of guys in the unit who are always giving me a really hard time because I'm gay. There's your statement under don't ask, don't tell. And more likely than not, that will result not in the reprimanding of the people in the unit, although it might, but it will also lead to a discharge or a potential discharge under don't ask, don't tell. So you have to walk people through having them go into their commanding officer or into their supervisor and saying, I believe that I'm being harassed on the basis of my perceived sexual orientation. I am not making a statement one way or the other regarding my sexual orientation. And that can be a lot if somebody's nervous, and especially if they're an 18-year-old, you know, E1, just basically signed up to keep that straight in their mind while they're speaking to their supervisor about something that could lead to the end of their job. In terms of the litigation update, I think everybody's very well familiar with the court cases that are happening now. Major Witt, who Michelle touched on earlier, that case was basically the case that laid the foundation for the Log Cabin Republicans case that I'm sure everyone in the room is familiar with. Major Witt's case was in the Ninth Circuit. It was in the Southern California District Court. And originally, her case was dismissed because the judge found that she was properly discharged. When Major Witt's attorneys appealed that decision, it went up to the Ninth Circuit, and the Ninth Circuit articulated a standard that said, we believe that the burden should be on the military to demonstrate that Major Witt was in fact becoming a problem for unit cohesion, good morale, you know, good order and discipline, things like this, the justifications for this law. And if you can't show that, if you can't show that she was in fact deserving of this discharge on the basis of your justifications for the law, that don't ask, don't tell was unconstitutionally applied to her. There was a trial. After that standard was articulated, it was remanded back to the court. There was a trial. A number of people testified as to the excellent she's a flight nurse, an excellent nurse that she was, the excellent service member that she was, the good impact that she had on her unit, and in fact the judge, the district court judge, under the standard articulated by the Ninth Circuit, really had no choice but to order her reinstatement. Currently, what's happening with that is the judge issued an order for her reinstatement to take place as soon as practicable. The Justice Department has 60 days from the date of that order to file a notice of appeal. That deadline is approaching on November 24th, so just a couple weeks away. If they do nothing, that's the end of the case, and Major Witt will be reinstated. If they do file a notice of appeal, they can either decide to file a notice of appeal by itself, in which case Major Witt will be reinstated pending the appeal of the case, or they can file a notice of appeal and petition for a stay of the order, in which case Major Witt would, if they prevail on that stay, not be reinstated pending appeal. So we're waiting to see what the Justice Department decides to do with that. And it's on the basis of that, or partially on the basis of that standard articulated by the Ninth Circuit, that the judge in the Log Cabin Republicans case, Judge Virginia Phillips, was able to rule the way she did. It's not exactly that she was bound by the Ninth Circuit Court's decision, because the Ninth Circuit Court's decision was in reference to an as-applied challenge, whereas the Log Cabin Republicans case was a successful facial challenge. But the judge in the district court in the Log Cabins case used the standard that the Ninth Circuit had articulated for the as-applied and used it on, you know, to rule on her facial challenge. We think that's phenomenal. We hope that the Ninth Circuit, when it hears a pending appeal of the Log Cabins case, adopts its standard for the facial challenge as well. We think the judge was correct to do so. But that's also a pending appeal. Many people have been familiar with the stay that's going on. The Log Cabins last week filed a petition to the Ninth Circuit, to the Supreme Court, to lift the Ninth Circuit's stay pending appeal. Justice Kennedy has asked the government to provide a response. That deadline is today. Either way, whether or not a stay is lifted or the stay is affirmed, the merits of the case will be moving forward on appeal, I believe, sometime early this spring. The deadline, I'm not sure that the date has been set on the calendar. So that's the litigation update. I mean, there's other litigation pending. One of our clients, Victor Fehrenbach, is a 19-year Air Force aviator. He's been decorated way too many times to count, and his performance evaluations, you know, use the word "the best airman I've ever seen," and, you know, this person is an 11 out of 10. He's just an incredible, incredible service member. And we can get into the facts of his case if people ask questions, but we, in order to maintain, he's at 19 years. If people don't know, at 20, you're entitled to full pension benefits and things like that with retirement. And so we filed suit to enjoin his discharge from moving forward because it was imminent. And so now he's just kind of waiting in limbo while his case moves forward. And I'm happy to take any questions on the litigation after Ty speaks about what we can expect from the Congress.
So our last panelist is Ty Cobb. Let me just remind everyone in the audience that you have slips of paper on which you can write down questions that the students will collect to pose to our panelists. So with that, Ty.
Hey, everyone. My name's Ty Cobb. I seem to have gotten elevated to legislative director today, which is nice. I work for the Human Rights Campaign. We're the largest LGBT civil rights organization in the U.S. We have around 750,000 members, and we work on equality issues at the state level, at the federal level, and we do not do direct litigation, so our work with the courts is more filing amicus briefs and tracking litigation. I'm going to take a little bit of a different turn. I'm going to go and talk about the legislative process and what's going on in Congress and also the administration, the Pentagon, and just kind of talk about what's happened this year and leave it for us to kind of discuss your questions where we're going from there. I'm going to start with the State of the Union this year, where the President said he was going to work for repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell with Congress in 2010. So that's how the year started out and moved into Senate hearings where both the Secretary of Defense and the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff both made statements that they agree with the President that it's time to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I brought one of the quotes from the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff just because I like the quote. And I think it's something that it was great to have happen at a Senate hearing from somebody, the head of the four branches or the person that chairs the branches. And Admiral Mullen said, "No matter how I look at this issue, I can't escape being troubled by the fact we have in place a policy which forces young men and women to lie about who they are in order to defend their fellow citizens. Then he said, "For me, this comes down to integrity. Theirs is individuals and ours is an institution." And I thought that was just a great quote that really kind of describes what this policy is, what it does, and what it says about our military for having this law on the books. And so, also at these hearings, the Secretary of Defense announced that he was going to put together a Pentagon working group to study Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And so not long after that, this is the first probably quarter of the year where this start, where these hearings are going on, and this is starting, I think, February or March we're in right now. And so he announces a Pentagon working group, and they were tasked with looking at how to implement a repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And you look at terms of references for that directive from the Secretary, and often this gets changed in the media as a review of whether or not to repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell, but it is how to implement repeal. So what needs to be changed? What policies? How do we extend benefits? What barriers are there to allow open service? And that report, which started in the earlier part of this year, is due on the Secretary's desk in less than 2 weeks. So on December 1st is when it lands on his desk and will be a complete review of how to actually repeal the law, or how to implement or repeal the law, what to do once the law is repealed. At the same time in the spring, there were two bills in Congress that had been introduced in the House and the Senate called the Military Readiness and Enhancement Act. I believe both those bills were sitting in place in the spring, but then later in the spring, the Defense Authorization Bill, which authorizes funds and other things for the Defense Department, was amended in both the House and in the Senate Armed Services Committee to include repeal legislation. So what happened was the repeal legislation got attached to a larger bill that was moving through, and so it's part of this larger bill going forward. In, I believe it was May, the House passed the Defense Authorization Bill, so they did their part. They passed the bill, and on their side, repeal legislation is final. And the Senate has yet to consider the Defense Authorization Bill. In September, it was moved forward, but it was blocked by a filibuster from going forward. So there was no movement in the Senate, and right now we are at the point where the last thing that needs to happen, the President has signed on, said he's committed to signing this. There's no doubt that the President will sign the bill. The House has passed it, and so we're waiting on the Senate. It's kind of the state of where we are. The Senate goes back in session on Monday for the lame duck session post-election and are in for a week and then out for Thanksgiving, then be in for at least two more weeks in December. And so that's where we're posed with legislative repeal. And during all this, we had, as my other colleagues on the panel were talking about, the Witt case was going on in the courts. The log cabin case was going on in the courts. There was a temporary time where Don't Ask, Don't Tell was the military was enjoined from enforcing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. So this has been an up-and-down ride where the policy is in effect one day, it's changed another day. The legislatively, it's up for a vote, being filibustered, but not going forward. So there's a lot of dynamics of what's going on in the courts, in the administration, as far as what the Pentagon Working Group is doing and what they're going to report back with on December 1st, and then also on Congress. So there's a lot of moving pieces around this. And I think one thing we haven't talked about is there's this question, is it better for the courts to find it unconstitutional? Is it better for there to be an injunction? Is it better for there to be a administrative action prohibiting the enforcement of Don't Ask, Don't Tell of some sort? People talk about this, or a stop-loss administrative action that stops discharges, or is it better for Congress to repeal the law? And I mean, I think obviously the answer is to get the law off the books. And I think the best way to do that is to, if the courts are going to knock it down as unconstitutional, that's good, but I think it's time for Congress to take it off the books. And I can answer other questions as we go forward. So if you have any questions about the process, just let me know.
So we're going to turn to the sort of moderated Q&A part of the program. Let me again encourage you all to write down questions. The students from the National Security Law Brief and from the Labor and Employment Law Brief are going to be passing through, picking up the questions. Ty, you sort of stole my thunder there at the end. Because my first question to all of our panelists is, you know, I suspect we can all agree that Congress has the constitutional authority to repeal a statute it enacted, right? And so it's certainly true that Congress could repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It's certainly true that the courts could strike down Don't Ask, Don't Tell. At this point, I'm curious for each of you, if you'd be willing to speculate, what do you think is most likely to happen in light of the election, in light of where the litigation stands? know, if you had to predict the future, will the Giants go to the Super Bowl? No. That's my question. Leaving aside what you think should happen, where do you think things actually will go from here?
Who's the two first?
Okay. I think I don't know. I'll be honest. I think when we get towards the other end of the panel, you guys are a lot more in tune with what's going on in the halls of Congress. I thought it was a done deal, and then I started reading the papers this morning. And I guess the pressure that Senator Carl Levin is under, both one way and the other, you know, to repeal, not to repeal. And I guess for 48 years, the Congress has consistently passed a defense authorization. It's a core task of Congress to do that. And so there's a lot of pressure on him from both sides to pass it the way each side wants it. I've already, you know, stated what I think should happen. I think it should be repealed, but I think it should be Congress that does it. Constitutionally, it's placed within, you know, Congress's powers. I would like to think there's a better than 50-50 chance that it's Congress that does it, and we don't end up with this being fought out in the courts ad nauseum for the next year and a half or so.
I agree with all the other panelists that it should be Congress who does the overturning. I'm just not sure that that's going to happen. And to take a little step back, the National Defense Authorization Act is the defense funding bill. It is what keeps the military running. It's, you know, trillions of dollars, or at least a trillion. And if you don't pass it, there is no budget. There is no money for the military except through these things that they call continuing resolutions, which is what we every year at this time of year find ourselves under, because the fiscal year started about a month and a half ago and we can never pass a budget by then. So this National Defense Authorization Act is extraordinarily important for everyone in Congress to make sure that we can still fund our military, especially given the wars that are being fought right now. But I don't think that there's that much political will in Congress. I won't say that much, because there is quite a bit of political will in Congress to overturn the policy, but I'm not sure that there's enough, particularly with the procedural rules that you can use in the Senate to prevent certain things from being passed. So unfortunately, maybe this is my pessimism coming through, unfortunately, I think it will probably be this very piecemeal interim court-decided repeal that's going to ricochet back and forth for quite some time. I hope that's not the case, but, aside from the constitutional reasons that it should be Congress that does the change in the law, I mean, it was Congress that passed it in the first place. It wasn't the military. So it should be Congress that does the repeal. But that would also allow an orderly, it would give a timetable, there would be guidelines, at least some minimal amount of guidelines that would come out of Congress if it happens that way. If it comes from the courts and they just say, policy unconstitutional, change it, there isn't the guidance, there isn't the opportunity for making incremental changes or whatever adjustments need to be made.
And I want to go back to the National Defense Authorization Bill as well. I'm trying to talk about it. The bill is huge, as she said. Michelle said it was around $1 trillion, probably. So Don't Ask, Don't Tell is such a small piece of that. If Congress does not pass the National Defense Authorization Act this year, it'll be the first time in, I believe, 48 years they have not passed that. So there is pressure on Senator Levin to get this bill through. I think that that Congress is in the position to make the most immediate change. They could make that change next week. Being back in session next week, they can make that change in 3 weeks when they get back in session. The courts are obviously going to be up and down, as we've seen now. We've seen the military enjoined from enforcing Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and then told they can do it again. And this kind of pattern can continue all the way up to the Supreme Court as the Ninth Circuit hears the case early next year. I certainly would welcome a favorable verdict from the Supreme Court or a decision from the Supreme Court on the unconstitutionality of Don't Ask, Don't Tell. But I think right now the Senate is poised in the position where they can be the most effective and most immediate change to the law by stripping it off the books. And also another caveat to that, the legislation in the Defense Authorization Act does not immediately strip Don't Ask, Don't Tell off the books. The way the legislation works is that, I believe, I'm trying to think back to this, there are three things that have to happen for the legislation after it is, before Don't Ask, Don't Tell to be stripped off the books, after the defense bill were to pass. First, the Defense Department report I talked about on December 1st, that has to be put out. So the Secretary of Defense has to get that report, which is less than 2 weeks away. Second, I believe the Secretary of Defense, the Chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, and the President have to provide the Senate Armed Services Committee and the House Armed Services Committee with a certified letter saying that repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell will not hurt the military, basically, military effectiveness, unit cohesion, based on the report. And then I think also there's a certification that they just received the report or have read the report. And so even if the Defense Authorization Bill passes, there is still a process that has to go before the law is stripped off the books and people are serving openly. But I do think Congress is in the position to make the most immediate action. The other thing that has to actually occur before the law would be stripped for the books is Congress has to be provided with draft regulations on how to implement a policy of open service.
Yeah, and I would echo everything Titus said. The group that can most readily and most quickly repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell is the people who put it in place in the beginning in 1993, which is the Senate and Congress in general. They're basically, you know, almost there. That doesn't mean that they'll get there, but they're almost there, and the Senate should vote in this lame duck to repeal. Barring that, you know, it's going to be fought in the courts. The courts don't go on a congressional or a political timetable, and they'll continue to act in accordance with whatever they judge the law to be. And that's not necessarily where political branches, and especially the military, likes to find themselves, subject to the whim of a judge's decision. And it's not a decision that they'll be making lightly. They'll be viewing it in the context of the Constitution. But that level of uncertainty for the military, I think, is not where they want to find themselves. And I think we saw that when the injunction was put in place. The military is excellent at figuring out how to implement something and doing it. I mean, there's a reason we have the best military in the world. But doing things that quickly and pushing it down the bureaucracy that fast posed some challenges. And so I don't think that they want to see that happen again on a bigger scale.
So I guess so that begs a related question, and maybe that's the answer to a related question, which is the Obama administration in all of this, right? So President Obama, in his first State of the Union, gets up and says, repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell is a priority. And at least at points, right, the administration has been very proactive on that front. At the same time, it's the same administration's Justice Department that's aggressively appealing, right? Judge Phillips ruling in the Log Cabin Republicans case, it's aggressively appealing the Witt case. One way to slice that is, well, you know, the Attorney General has a constitutional obligation to defend the constitutionality of federal law. But, you know, there's defending it and then there's defending it. So I'm curious if you guys think there's any inconsistency in what we've seen different parts of the administration doing on this issue, and if you think maybe part of the problem at the moment is not enough in the way of sort of a clear message from the president on where to go with this.
I'm not sure. I mean, I think that the Attorney General does have the obligation to defend the constitutionality of the laws. And I think if the president wants to speak in that manner, then he needs to go the executive order route. If he's going to speak, then speak. But otherwise, I think defending the laws, you know, is part of the role of the Attorney General and something they have to do. So I don't want to hand it off to the next speaker.
I actually heard Neil Katyal, the acting Solicitor General, speak about his office and the role of his office on a day where he had to jet out of the room because the injunction had just come down and he needed to go chat with the White House. And it was interesting that the things that we've heard before of it's their job as the Solicitor's Office to defend whatever is not been deemed unconstitutional up to that point, whether it's popular and, you know, whether whatever the political winds are brewing, including that of the current administration, which I thought was really interesting because my view of the solicitor's office had been more of, hey, you're working for the president, so you follow what he has to say. And so that was an interesting insight to me, a very timely one. And I have heard, though, that they don't always, the Solicitor General's office doesn't always kind of knee-jerk defend every provision of the U.S. Code. So there's some discretion, but it's definitely a muddled message.
I would say they've been very consistent at being inconsistent. They continuously, how would we say this? They continuously rely on their duty to defend all laws, whether or not they agree with them. So they're consistent in that sense. They continue to defend Don't Ask, Don't Tell and the Defense of Marriage Act and other laws like that, but at the same time are inconsistent in the president just in 2009 explained that, stated that Don't Ask, Don't Tell weakens national security, which is the basis for which Congress actually enacted the law. So he himself, to a certain extent, understands the unconstitutionality of the law. There was no basis there for enacting that law. But they continue on defending the law with the duty to defend. But at HRC, we do not believe that the law is constitutional. We believe it's unconstitutional, and there's precedent that the Justice Department does not have to defend an unconstitutional law. But the administration has been very consistent in defending these types of laws.
Yeah, I would just add a couple of points. Not to confuse Ty's argument, but the Justice Department did not appeal the Witt decision from the Ninth Circuit, which is, I think directly on point here. When the Ninth Circuit articulated its standard and basically said that there's going to be a burden shift in Don't Ask, Don't Tell cases in the Ninth Circuit, at least with respect to as-applied challenges, that case was not appealed to the Supreme Court, and that's why that rule, I think, still stands today. It's why people are thinking about bringing cases in the Ninth Circuit because the law there is just simply better. And with respect to the executive order issue that was brought up, I think there's some – it'd be great if it could be done in an executive order or done tomorrow, but I think that there are some legitimate constitutional questions as to whether or not the president has authority under stop loss to issue an executive order. I think it would also raise a host of other potentially unexpected consequences with respect to divisions of government.
I have one more question for the panel before we turn it over to the student questions. So I come at this from a different perspective, I think, than the four of you, which is sort of the top-down perspective. You know, this is sort of a piece of a larger puzzle. And the larger puzzle that I see in teaching constitutional law is lots of different areas where laws that discriminate on the basis of sexual orientation are at the forefront of policy and legal debates, right? So the Prop 8 lawsuits in California, the challenges to the constitutionality of DOMA, right? Some of you may know on Tuesday, Iowa voted out three of their state Supreme Court justices almost entirely in response to a unanimous decision by their Supreme Court that same-sex marriage is protected by the Iowa Constitution, right? So I'm curious if you guys see Don't Ask, Don't Tell as a unique variation on this theme or as part of a much larger growing national conversation and whether there are ways in which Don't Ask, Don't Tell is either a poorer or better vehicle for those who are interested in moving ahead on questions of sexual equality in the 21st century.
I'll go ahead and say I think that it's a terrible vehicle for moving this discussion forward because even in the to back up in 2003, the Supreme Court in Lawrence versus Texas, declared unconstitutional all of these laws, state laws, prescribing consensual sodomy between two adults in the comfort of their bedroom, not anything use of force or anything. It's just strictly privacy within the bedroom. And that was once again applied by the Court of Appeals for the Armed Forces to knock up some of the prosecutions for this conduct. But the same article that I was talking about that, you know, that said that it was mostly dead but still partly alive said that the way that the sort of the loophole that's been left by the Court of Appeals and the Armed Forces makes the military exception that's created by that case means that the sodomy article of the UCMJ is still mostly alive, not totally dead. So I think that the strong policy considerations in favor of discipline of the force just make this a tougher area. If you're going to litigate, this is a tougher area than in other areas. And, you know, I think it was the same week, actually, that Judge Phillips' decision came down. You had the defense of marriage statute partially overruled in Massachusetts, I think, where there's a federal employee who, I want to say, wanted to get benefits for their partner. Is that's correct?
From OPM.
Right. So you see the difference, you know, when you have both federal agencies, but one military, one non-military. This is clearly swimming upstream to get things done on Don't Ask, Don't Tell.
Maybe because I came from a military background, I would say in many ways it's a tougher sell with the military, but there may be a silver lining that makes it a little bit better. And so I'll talk about both. But, following along with what David said, he's referring to the United States versus Markham case, which if you want to look it up and read it, is at 60 MJ198. It's a 2004 case. My boss argued it. I was there when it was argued. Very, very interesting. Most of us, I think, thought, Lawrence v. Texas, that pretty much means the end of Article 125 unless you can be quite clever with the argument, and I guess she was, or, you know, they bought it regardless of argument because you always hear argument doesn't matter as much as the briefs. But anyway, the military has always gotten traditionally very high deference from the courts in particular, which is another reason that the courts, in my opinion, are not the best branch of government to be deciding the issue. Now, you see, when we keep talking about the Ninth Circuit case, gives a little less deference to the military than what you traditionally see. And you see some of that with the cases involving the detainees. You're seeing less deference to the military, too, and the Supreme Court. But so that sort of swimming upstream, and you've got, I mean, if it's just a traditional, hey, is Defense of Marriage Act constitutional, or should partners get benefits, that sort of thing, you don't have the issues that you have in the military, where military members have always given up some of their rights. I mean, military members are not allowed to say things like, I hate the president, and the president's the stupidest person on the planet, you know, he's got the dumbest decisions and makes the stupidest arguments, and, you know, write a letter to the editor and sign your name and say General so-and-so. The same as a lot of other things that we give up the right. I mean, we give up the right to refuse immunizations and that sort of stuff. So that makes it a tougher sell. On the other side, you have the history of the military, because the military is used to following orders, that if and when policies change, people, whether they agree with the policy or not, whether they, you know, have their own personal opinions, have been taught, and we saw this with integration, and we've seen as far as the races as well as the sexes, that if individuals are told, here's the new policy, here's what you need to do, people are going to salute smartly and they're going to go.
I not to belabor the point, but I think you're right in the sense that the courts deal with the military as a different type of animal than society at large, and just the way the courts apply the law and constitutional principles to the military aren't necessarily applicable outside of that small space. So I don't know that it is necessarily the best vehicle for kind of advancing the LGBT equality strategy in the judiciary. But like I said, I would certainly welcome a favorable decision.
Yeah, like I said, I don't think that any ruling favorable to Don't Ask, Don't Tell would necessarily be translatable to a broader LGBT agenda, because, like you said, those those things are dealt with by the court separately. The one thing I would point out, though, is that they do seem to be dealt with by the public at large somewhat differently, in that approval for repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell is upwards of 75%, and that's across parties, that's across weekly churchgoers. I mean, it is a very high, it's not 75% on all of those groups, but on average, yeah, I mean, it is a very, very high number of people who are not just indifferent, but in favor of repealing Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And I don't think the same can be said for other aspects of the LGBT agenda, unfortunately.
Justin, you want to share some of the student questions?
We have been getting a lot of questions regarding the filibuster, so I'm just going to combine a couple of them right now. one of the main questions was, were there any other express reasons for the filibuster? And we say this in terms of, it seemed like the main talking point for the filibuster was that the military's report had not come out yet. And yet, it seems that, as Ty and David stated, that in fact did not necessarily have anything to do with eventual passage of the authorization bill. So I guess a multi-part question, were there any express reasons for the filibuster? Do we expect those reasons to come up again? And if and when we see the report, do we feel that the filibuster is still the biggest structural obstacle to the repeal of Don't Ask, Don't Tell?
Definitely. Looking back at September is when the bill didn't survive. The Senate bill, the National Defense Authorization Act, did not survive the filibuster vote. We would like to think that was just because of just Don't Ask, Don't Tell or something of that sort, but like Michelle said, that bill is far beyond a small little piece. It had to do with a lot of things going on in Congress at the time, including upcoming elections, including other amendments such as, I don't know if you guys know about the DREAM Act, is something that was kind of part of those deliberations. It was a political maneuver.
And jet engines as well.
Jet engines.
But, I mean, the DREAM Act, I mean, if I recall correctly, at least publicly, right, the DREAM, Senator Reid, I guess he's still Senator Reid, mm-hmm. You know, had attached the DREAM Act. The DREAM Act is an immigration reform measure, mm-hmm. And he'd attached it rather late. Which is not to say that Republicans hadn't attached things late, but that there was a sort of a process objection behind the filibuster.
Right, and I think he wanted to vote on the DREAM Act, and I think that other individuals had opposing views. There were many issues on the defense authorization bill, why it didn't go forward. It wasn't just Don't Ask, Don't Tell. And actually, I don't think Don't Ask, Don't Tell was by no means the major talking point on the defense authorization bill going forward. What were some of the rest of that? What was the rest of those questions? Oh, right. No, I do find it interesting. But when Don't Ask, Don't Tell was brought up in this debate, a lot of times there's this reticence to move forward until the December 1st report comes out. It'll tell us if we should repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. First, as I said earlier, the report does not talk about whether we should repeal Don't Ask, Don't Tell. It says what policy changes on the military side need to be done to implement a repeal. It already considers the idea Don't Ask, Don't Tell will be repealed. It's saying, what do we need to do? What regulations here do we need to change? What benefits do we need to provide? What benefits can we provide legally? So there's a lot of people relying on this idea. There were several people that opposed the moving forward on the defense bill, in some part because they did not want to move until this December 1st report comes out. So obviously, once the December 1st report comes out, that talking point is gone. I am sure there will be a new talking point, as there always is, but that talking point does disappear December 1st. And going forward, I would expect a filibuster because the Senate has probably filibustered almost every bill that's gone through this year. It's just, you don't see much movement in the Senate without a filibuster.
Ty, don't you also, I mean, this is just thinking out loud, but don't you also suspect that if it looks close, there's going to be a process objection that lame duck senators should sort of not be moving ahead on legislation that their replacements probably would not be supportive of?
I've never heard that.
Okay.
I don't know.
I don't want to give anyone ideas.
I don't think so, because there's this expectation that the National Defense Authorization Act is passed every year. And I don't think that a process issue like that is what is going to stop the National Defense Bill going forward.
It might affect other legislation, but not this?
I think so, because this is something that we expect every year. This is something that's happened for almost 50 years at this point. And so it's stranger that we did not go through the process of passing it than to pass it after midterm elections.
Which has been done before.
Yeah.
Moving more towards the report itself, again, combining a couple questions here. It was mentioned earlier that the UK and Israel do allow openly gay service members. One, is the DOD in this report trying to study these and other international examples? Then two, along those lines, could you speak about how the military will have to change its internal policies if and when service members are allowed to serve as openly gay service members, and specifically, how will this deal with issues such as incentivizing marriage? Will they be allowed the same marriage benefits as current heterosexual couples, as well as the overall social policies of the military, specifically have to deal with the often homophobic environment that is often stated against homosexuals?
So I'll take that because I mentioned the other militaries. So let me just tease that out. I think there's like three questions. Like, how will this affect combat readiness? How are we going to, implement this? And I think the second one was the broader legal scope of, family law or whatever you want to call it. And the third one, which I'm just going to disregard right now, is the homophobic nature of the military. I mean, the folks that are enlisting right now, I think Colin Powell was right. 17 years ago, this was a tougher sell. But I think times have changed, and the kids coming in the military now do not have the hang-ups that were in place 17 years ago. It's just changed. It's a generational change in the folks that are, coming in and enlisting right now. But back to the first one. Yeah, the British and Israelis have done it. I'm certain that they're looking at this. It's actually been done before. This has been studied before by the RAND Corporation, and other folks have already looked at this and looked at the personnel policies of these other militaries. And I'm certain that whatever they're going to produce is going to, in large part, mirror whatever the Brits and the Israelis do. The reason I focus on the British and the Israelis is because they have real militaries that really fight. I don't care what Luxembourg does. I'm great, if they let people serve gay openly, good for them. But we should focus on, like the question says, what are the folks who have top-notch combat units doing? I think it's actually the second part of that, how does this fit in the broader legal scheme, gets back to what Stephen was saying about, where does this fit in sort of the broader, discussion? And I think that the marriage piece of it, I don't think that you can address all of, do service members get to, marry, have same-sex marriages and have them honored until Congress revisits DOMA and looks at what they're doing there.
Yeah, I just piggyback on the back of that. First, I do want to reemphasize the first point you made, which is the kind of lack of homophobia in the military, especially in regards to the younger recruits. Military Times, which is did a poll of its readership, which is widely considered to be kind of an older, more conservative readership. And for the first time this year, they found that just over 50% of their readers found that, were in favor of or didn't care whether or not Don't Ask, Don't Tell was repealed. And those numbers just climb as you get down to people who are younger. And, it's really a generational issue. The people who are signing up now haven't lived in a world without Don't Ask, Don't Tell. I mean, this is a 17-year-old law, and the kids who are signing up right before they graduate from high school are often that age, believe it or not, and which gives them the birthday of like 92, 93. So it's just not as much of an issue. That's not to say that homophobia doesn't exist in the military, as it does lots of places, but the military is a very, very capable and disciplined organization, and that doesn't change in this case. With respect to the laws or regulations that might need to be changed, I'll be brief here, but for a lot of the benefits issues, there may be a DOMA issue there as much as anything else. That's not to say that there aren't some potential workarounds, but that's exactly what the Comprehensive Working Group is doing right now, which is figuring out exactly what regulations would need to be changed. The one thing that would not need to be changed, or very little of it would need to be changed, is the are regulations based on conduct. Most of the regulations based on conduct, whether sexual misconduct or other misconduct, are sexual orientation neutral. They don't deal with whether or not a man assaults a woman or a straight man assaults a straight woman. I mean, it's not how they're written, and nor would it probably occur to anybody to write them that way. If there's an assault, it's dealt with as to whether or not one person sexually assaults another person. And in fact, I believe there's some historical research to find that when some of the sexual assault provisions were written, it was before women were widely serving in the military. It was in order to prevent same-sex male-on-male sexual assaults. So I think these are totally applicable. They're totally capable of providing any sort of discipline that the military needs to enforce, and the rest will have to be visited after repeal.
I think it's kind of premature to make that to guess what that is, and that simply because we're going to find out in about 9 days, wherever we are. December 1st, we'll get an idea of, when surveying troops, their families, where the military lies on this issue, where it stands. But something to think about. You kind of talked about leadership and the different levels of leadership and what's required to do a change like this. And you also talked about looking at foreign armies. I do know that in this working group, they are looking at foreign armies. They're updating the old RAND report, which was made back in the 90s, where they evaluated how other militaries made this type of change to open service. And one of the key ways this is done is it's done quickly, and it's pushed by the leadership at the top. It's a clear, quick change where the leadership says this is how it's going to be. And so I assume that the report coming out on December 1st finds that the military is ready for this. And I expect that the leadership within the military plans to kind of be assertive in implementing these new policies, simply because I know that will be the guidance that will likely come out of the RAND report, because that's how other countries have dealt with it.
I think the leadership component cannot be understated, and maybe David or Michelle would like to speak to how much of a difference leadership, from especially within the context of a chain of command, really does influence the way people behave in the service.
I would just say that there's been some differing views coming from the service chiefs, and I think just as late as last week, maybe this week, the chief of the Marine Corps was saying, there's an exception of policy for the Marines, where the Navy would have like a certain amount of space that each person is supposed to have. The Marine Corps has an express exemption of that, and they live in austere conditions. And so he opposes the change of the policy based on that service's requirements. But the bottom line is that you know, once the military is told to do something and the leadership gets involved and, you know, makes an order effective, then they're going to execute the order.
It should also just be noted very quickly that there are current. It's not that there are no gay and lesbian service people today. There's on the order estimated, because obviously we can't ask them to tell us who they are, but estimated 66,000 service members, which is not the vast majority of the service by any stretch. But you know, there are people. You rarely speak to somebody who served any length of time who can credibly say that they've never served with or known somebody in the military who was gay.
I guess this leads to my next question, which is, so what is life after Don't Ask, Don't Tell, right? I mean, you know, presumably there's still going to be concerns about, you know, one of you mentioned in your remarks the harassment, right, and the anti-harassment policy. David, I think it was you, right? And I guess the question is, you know, how to sort of adequately balance respect for equality with the particular needs of the military. Would you sort of, you know, counsel leaders in the Pentagon, leaders in Congress to construct a sort of viable, non-discriminatory policy that actually accounts for, you know, I think the parts of Don't Ask, Don't Tell that actually are
sensible, right? The parts of Don't Ask, Don't Tell that come from a place that, you know, justify it.
I'll tackle that first. I mean, there are a lot of things that we'll have to deal with under new policies. What do you do about the Lieutenant Choys and the Margaret Witts and the other folks who've been discharged already? How do you reintegrate them and get them back to where they would have been, or where, you know, they haven't lost all this time and stature and all that? But, a post homosexual conduct is means for discharge world in the military, it is going to be mainly a factor of the leadership. I mean, my dad used to repeat the phrase, the speed of the boss is the speed of the gang. And as long as you have leaders, which by and large you do right now, I mean, I know from just thinking about my last duty station, even when we had a case where there was an allegation of homosexual assault, we dealt very gingerly with the individual who was accused because it is a very sensitive area. And this is under the policy that homosexual conduct is not compatible with military service. But once the policy is changed, you're going to see even more of an emphasis. I mean, we already, on a yearly basis in some services, others I've seen the policy is actually twice yearly, we do things like fraternization, anti-fraternization briefings and briefings on here's what is sexual harassment and here's, because like the others have said, you already have homosexuals in the military, whether they're civilians, whether they're contractors, whether they're other service members. And just this respect for your fellow service members, it detracts from the mission if you've got individuals who are harassing others. So I'm not sure that there would be new policies. There just might be new emphasis on this includes homosexual bashing. But I really think that for a large number of individuals, at least at the beginning, even under a new policy, they're still going to think, okay, well, if I do come out, am I going to have some sort of ramifications against me, whether it's subconsciously, whether it's in my performance report, my assignments that I get? I think the policy change may be rapid, but it may not be as rapid as we think it will be.
Yeah, if I can just add a couple of things to that. I think there's two broad issues after Don't Ask, Don't Tell that I think are worth thinking about. The first is an easy one, and much easier than the second one, which is the first is what to do intermilitary with personnel policies and things like that. That can be dealt with. There's a mechanism for dealing with it. There's a working group considering it. There's groups like ours who are dedicating an enormous amount of time to it. That's a solvable problem in a fairly straightforward manner. The second is what to do with people who were discharged and who've been out of the service for some time now, or even just a little bit of time, who want to go back in. Listen, there's a few issues that are really important there. Do you give credit to the people who were discharged for all the time that they would have had? Do they go in at the rank that they were or the rank that they would have been? If there are no spots open for radar technicians in a certain unit where the person was discharged, do you create one for them? I mean, it will be a potentially complicated issue to deal with. That doesn't mean that it's not worth doing, and it doesn't mean that fairness and justice don't require that of us. It just means that it might take a little longer. The other thing I wanted to point out is that a lot of people, when we're discussing these things, have the assumption is kind of that when Don't Ask, Don't Tell will be repealed, gay and lesbian service members will be known to their counterparts, which may be true, but it may not be. Nobody has to come out on the day after Don't Ask, Don't Tell is repealed. And if you think about the way life works, most people probably won't. People don't come out until they're safe and comfortable and think that they won't be subject to any sort of reprimand or harassment. So it might be the case that the policy changes and that the factual, practical matter of the policy is not being implemented as quickly, but that won't impact somebody necessarily unless they've made the determination that they're going to be coming out, that they think they're in a safe environment, and things like that.
Great. Well, thank you to our panelists. We have one last closing treat before we leave today. Here to give us some closing remarks is Tony Verona, who's a professor of law and the associate dean for Faculty and Administrative Affairs here at WCL.
Thank you so much, Steve. I will be very, very brief because I was not able to attend the panel and to hear you, and I wouldn't want to retread ground that you've covered. But I will share with you that I had the privilege of working on Don't Ask, Don't Tell repeal some years back. And I can tell you that my experience has been over the last few years that nothing much has changed, right? This is a policy problem, a political problem, a legal problem that is of a very interesting sort in that it seems to us that the American public, and by us what I mean is the LGBT civil rights movement, seems to us, according to all the polling and what we've been told by people who we trust, that the American public is on the side of repeal, that Congress, by and large, is on the side of repeal. The president has told us that he is in favor of repeal. The courts are telling us that they're in favor of repeal. So where's the repeal? And the question becomes one of tactics and strategy and repealing in the right way, according to the right sequencing, whatever that might be. And so the theoretical question of whether repeal is the right way to go becomes how to repeal and when. And I am certain that that's the complicated question that you struggled with the most during this panel. So I bring you greetings and thanks from Dean Grossman, who is very happy that this panel took place, and he would have been here had the Committee Against Torture at the UN been scheduled their proceedings for another time, but he offers you his thanks and his greetings. Thank my colleague, Professor Vladek, for doing what I'm sure was a fantastic job, as he always does, moderating. And I thank Michelle McClure, David McKeon, Ty Cobb. Ty, have we ever met? Where's Ty? He left.
So no.
And we will not be meeting. He's still at the Human Rights Campaign. I'm a former General Counsel Legal Director there, and I don't think our paths have crossed. And David Ritkers, thank you very much. I also thank everybody who put the program together, from the Program on Law and Government to the National Security Law Brief, the Labor and Employment Law Forum, Lambda Law Society, Legislation, the Legislation and Policy Brief, the Modern American, Veterans of American University, the Health Law and Justice Initiative, and AU Queers and Allies. So thank you all very much. Thank you for a job well done. And have a great rest of the week.